The show you're about to hear was originally broadcast November 3rd, 2005. And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
Is it a dream or a nightmare? Imagine, if you will, becoming a member of the pack, living with wolves in the wilds of Idaho for 6 years. A dream? A nightmare? We find out when your voice of the earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News, and now, Sydney Wildsmith.
As the first snows begin turning this year of weather into the next expression of climate change, who knows what may lie ahead. The wild creatures get ready to deal with it, as they have for thousands and millions of years. Imagine you're a field mouse in Illinois, and the first snow has fallen. The light first snow is taller than you. How do you know what to do? And if you've been through this before, are there memories of the winter, running the under-snow pathways you've cut as your new domain? Or what if you're a bison on Yellowstone, where the winter has already made its first stand? Does the brisk winds, laden with icy crystals that cling and cake to your face, how does it make you feel? How does it change the way you look into the dark eyes of your clan? Or a wolf in the sawtooth ranges of Idaho. Your first winter as a yearling pup. What does this mean to you? How might this affect you and your pack? Today, we take a look at animals and their perceptions. That wolf pack in Idaho, it's for real. And today's guests, Jim and Jamie Dutcher, spent 6 years living with the sawtooth pack. These Emmy Award-winning filmmakers share their perceptions, which they've captured in a wonderful new book, Living with Wolves, published by Mountaineers Books. We go in-depth into the realms of being wolf and the mysteries of the pack. And now, let's find out what living with wolves is all about. Having grown up in Minnesota, I was very fortunate, and when I started my career as a naturalist, to be able to say, hey, I live in the state where we have wolves. And there was a very active program of researching wolves and protecting wolves, and one of the first. And from that grew a lot of the research and the efforts to maintain and protect wolves in the continental United States, which is actually succeeding to some degree. Joining us now on Wild Side News are two people who've had a most amazing experience with wolves. They have a new book out called Living with Wolves. And this is Jim and Jamie Dutcher. I want to welcome you to the Wild Side News.
Thank you, Sydney.
Yeah, thank you so much for having us.
First of all, let's talk about your new book. It's Living with Wolves, produced by great friends of mine at Mountaineers Books. This is going to be part of a companion to the video, because you both are, Jim, you're a videographer, and Jamie, you really focus on sound, but you are a team. But tell us the nature of the book, Living with Wolves, and its relationship to the video.
Well, it's based on our experiences with the wolves, but also a background of what wolves are all about. In the back of the book, there's a CD of vocalizations that Jamie put together.
It really is a bit of extension from the film, in that it gives people more of an insight of what these wolves are really all about and how they are connected to the natural world. And you may or may not know, Mountaineers is a nonprofit publisher, and we've done this with them in conjunction with the Wilderness Society to sort of make people a little bit more aware of how important it is to save the environment. We've got to remember to save our open spaces and leave corridors open in order for animals like wolves to be able to return to their natural place.
There is a film that's associated with the book. How can people find out more about the film?
Well, the film was produced for the Discovery Channel as an anniversary special. It's 95 minutes long. And it came out in May, and it's available through their website. But the film is basically the whole history of the Sawtooth Pack, a pack of wolves that we raised from puppies, and what happened to them. And it's the story of their family.
Well, let's talk about this Sawtooth. Now, first of all, you're located in Ketchum, Idaho, which is is grand extension of God's country, and specifically, you started this project in an area around Stanley, Idaho.
That's right.
I've been to Stanley. There's an ancient picture of me sitting there beside some sort of falling over structure, some sort of old miner's shack. Is that still there?
Yeah. The shack is probably there. Yeah, I know what you're talking about. It's a very small place, about 50, 60 people, something like that. It's like maybe 100 in the summer.
Yes. Well, it is really a perfect expression of the wild and open spaces, and Idaho has that. And the Sawtooth Range itself is an extraordinary area. Let's talk about the Sawtooth Range a little bit so people have a sense of what that area is like.
The Sawtooths are a range of mountains, sort of similar to the Tetons in central Idaho. And what we did is we set up a camp up in the mountains there, right on the edge of wilderness. And our approach in making this film was to get close to the wolf, to get into the inner lives of wolves. And wolves are extremely afraid of people. And to see a wolf in the wild is difficult. And to capture their social behavior on film is almost impossible. So we started this project with pups, bottle feeding these puppies from the moment they were opening their eyes. And then we built this enclosure, which we later camped within, and released the pups in there, and over the years introduced new pups. Wolves love pups, and they bonded to the new litter year after year. And then eventually, at the end of the project, we had a litter born to our pack, which we called the Sawtooth Pack. And it was probably the first litter of pups born in the Sawtooth in 50 or 60 years.
Yes. How big an enclosure did you create?
The enclosure was huge. It was 25 acres in size. It contained ponds and streams and aspen groves. It was really quite a wild setting, and we would have to travel on a snowmobile in the winter of 5 or 6 miles and all-terrain vehicle in the summertime just to bring in supplies.
Yeah, Stanley often records the coldest temperatures in the lower 48 in the winter, and we'd have temperatures that would hover around 40 below for days at a time. And it's important to note that, you know, when people hear, oh, you know, you did this in an enclosure, all studies on wolf behavior have been done in enclosures, but usually of 1 to 3 acres. So we had the largest wolf enclosure in the world because wolves are so sensitive when there are people around. You can't really see this behavior in the wild. You have to do it in a captive setting.
Well, and of course, the reason for that is that through the many years, they've learned that humans primarily mean disaster for them.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Yes, people have eliminated the wolf. There were about 2 million of them that were killed. There was bounties set on them, and once the bounties were set, they killed off the wolves in about a decade or so. And mostly that's because wolves are so bonded to each other. They're a family. And there were horrible tactics that they used, like baiting fish hooks and putting them down dens and bringing out the pups, and the pack would come back to defend the pups, and then they would be shot.
Thank God we've progressed way past that to a large extent so far. Let's keep that growing. That's obviously one of your missions, is to make sure that people really can appreciate the complex and extraordinary nature of the wolf and the wolf pack.
Yeah, that's exactly right, Sidney. What we're trying to do is talk about how social and caring this animal is. We were amazed at how, as a family animal, how they taught their young and cared for each other. They settled disputes. They mourned lost relatives. They were quite a family.
Well, let's start out with this. You started out with 6 small wolf pups. What was it like? You had a challenge because you wanted to be able to have them become comfortable with you as humans, but without really affecting their behaviors and acculturating them into a human society. That had to be a challenge.
It was, and you know, what we basically did is, you know, as Jim said before, we started off just before they were opening their eyes, and they were the first things that we saw, and we would bottle feed them, and we would really treat them as a mother wolf would do that. We would, where the mother wolf would use her tongue to lick and soothe the pups, we would use warm towels and washcloths. We would nurse them. We would just be around them. We made a point to not assert ourselves on the wolves. They would, you know, they would play around us, and wolf pups can get incredibly aggressive. And, you know, we would just kind of gently, you know, put the pup down a little bit and growl at it as its mother would. And then, you know, they would go on. But we didn't want the wolves to grow up looking at us as dominant members and change their behavior. We wanted to be completely neutral. And it really seemed to work. The wolves were comfortable around us. We could have our equipment out. We could be filming them, and they wouldn't stop what they were doing. And we were just there. They would have their disputes with one another inches from our face. They would be growling at each other, and we could just be sitting there. And it had nothing to do with us. And you'll see pictures in the book and then scenes in the film as well where we're very close to the wolves. You know, we're touching the wolves. And it's important to know that all of that was on their terms. The wolves came to us if they chose to. We didn't go to them.
During that first year, as these young pups were growing up, and they were pups at that point, and they didn't really have an adult to do the kind of basic training. You kind of were that, but you weren't at the same time. How much time did you really spend with them? Were they in the enclosure running free, and then you would enter the enclosure and interact?
Well, with the pups, we would raise them right there in the camp, in the tent, bottle feeding them, staying up with them during the night. You know, we'd have different shifts and take turns. But we have to feed them about 3 to 5 times a day.
Mm-hmm.
As they grew older, we introduced them into the larger enclosure and later new litters after that. And so they had a lot of space to roam.
Now, also, how would you help them to do wolf things, the hunting, the stalking, that type of thing?
Well, they seemed to have that instinct in them. They knew they would chase after mice and squirrels and rabbits. It seemed to be not learned behavior, but instinctive behavior.
Yeah, I think what they're finding, you know, with some reintroduced wolves, that, you know, wolves that are not familiar, for instance, with bison, have a very hard time killing bison because they're not used to that kind of a prey. But the hunting instinct is there in the animals. So our wolves were able to hunt and stalk small game in the enclosure, rabbits, squirrels, foxes that would get in, some birds. But because it was an enclosure, we would have to bring them their larger meals. We would bring them roadkill, deer, elk, and antelope. And they would settle, you know, work out their hierarchies, and we would watch that amongst the carcass.
I'd just be curious. That, of course, is one of the most fascinating aspects of wolves, and that is this hierarchy in the pack. How soon were you able to begin to distinguish what appeared to be some sort of hierarchy in this the six initial wolves?
What we noticed right away with the puppies that they had their own hierarchy within the puppy pack. And as years went on, that shifted a great deal. But for some reason, the little pup, Kamatz, which was turned out to be the alpha, always seemed to have a lot of confidence. And if I picked up that pup and moved him away, he would be very relaxed. Now, if I picked up another pup, she would be perhaps uncomfortable with being separated from her litter mates and want to get back on the ground and want to dominate them because she wasn't too sure of where her position was. But the alpha pup, he knew right away where he belonged.
When did you initiate them into the enclosures? Trying to get a sense of timing here, and they would have to overwinter, and that's a tough winter up there.
Right. The pups are born in spring, and by winter, they need to be full-grown practically, so they can run with a pack and be able to keep up and go through the deep snow and feed. So they grow very aggressively, very fast, and it seems like the alphas, the adults, would almost force that on the pups so that they would mature in a rapid way. We started our project with not just these pups, but also two adults. And they were socialized to people, but not to ourselves. And they were all right, but they never seemed to be quite relaxed with us. And they would dominate the puppy pack. In the film, you can see one of them had cataracts, and that's a whole other story. And she sort of separated herself apart, and we went into an operation on her, actually. Yeah. Sedating her, putting in her into the tent, got a physician from Oregon, and he came out and performed cataract operation on this pup. Mm-hmm. But the adults would teach the pups quite a bit, and but they never seemed to, the adults never seemed to bond with us. So we decided that it was after the eye operation, it was time to get rid of the two adults and stick with the sawtooth pack puppies. And that's what we did.
Yeah, but generally, you know, since we had the adult pups, pretty much as soon as the pups were done nursing and were on solid food, they would be introduced into the enclosure with the adult wolves. So that would be like late spring, early summer, and they would just, you know, continue to grow and eat with the adults. And then by wintertime, you know, they've got their big fluffy coats and they look beautiful, and they're pretty much set for winter.
Were you able to introduce larger game to give these wolves the opportunity to do what they are instinctively inclined to do, and that is to take down as a pack a larger game?
Well, Sydney, actually, we would have loved to have done that. But because these wolves were born in captivity and they were never going to be set free because they had lost the one thing they needed to survive in the wild, which was the fear of humans, it really wouldn't have been the right thing to do to put you know, a deer or an elk in an enclosed situation for the wolves to go after. So we made a decision early on that we would not do something like that, because we know that wolves hunt large game. We know they travel long distances for a living, and this film was primarily about their social behavior. They did go after small game in the enclosure that was in there all the time, like rabbits, squirrels, birds, but for the large part, the larger ungulates that they were fed on a regular basis, the deer, elk, and antelope, were roadkill, and we would bring those in. And they were fed on a rotating schedule, which is exactly what it would be like in the wild. Instead of like in a zoo situation where they're fed every day, they're fed every 5 to 7 days.
Let's talk about year two and what began to develop in the pack.
Well, this was a six-year project, and the first 3 years we produced one film, and then the next 3 years we produced another. And it was interesting to see that it really took about 3 years to study the behavior and see the family life of this pack. At the beginning, what we had was the four pups and two adults. And about the middle of that, about year two, we took the two adults away, and we introduced another litter of three pups. Mm. And so the sub-adults now are the alphas, and we had a new litter, and that was just wonderful for the pack. They love pups. You know, they would be so excited to lead them and bond with them, and they would also dominate them. They would make them roll over on their backs and submit, and just form a hierarchy. So and then on the third year we moved our camp, which was outside the enclosure, into the enclosure, and what we noticed is that the wolves were always so aware of what was going on in our camp when it was on the other side of the fence that it was disruptive if we would go be with the wolves. So we moved our camp amongst them, and they stopped behaving. They started behaving more naturally because we were always there. And we started to seeing things that we had never seen before, because their focus now was on their family and not the human observers.
Just kind of give us a sense of, over the 6 years, what began to happen within that pack.
Well, over the 6 years, we really got a chance to see the hierarchy really develop with each new litter of pups that we introduced to the pack. the dynamics of the hierarchy changed a little bit. The alpha, Kamath was always the alpha, but there were shifts in the omega position. It was interesting that in the second year, we had a wolf introduced by the name of Matsi, who really took on the role as Beta, second in command, and he held that position all the way through. But it gave a chance through the project for the mid-ranking wolves to sort of shift in and out of their mid-ranking position, and it just made for a much richer social structure for us to watch, which, you know, just developed into to just a huge understanding of what these animals are all about.
Well, we're talking with Jim and Jamie Dutcher, who have a new book out called Living with Wolves, and when we come back, we're going to start getting to the daily routines of what it means to be a wolf and what it means to be a wolf in a wolf pack. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
It's an age-old debate whether animals have any real sense of reality, or are they essentially organic machines with no real awareness. Biologists, psychologists, and behaviorists, to name a few key players in the debate, tend to support the thesis that animals are incapable of, heaven forbid, things like compassion, sorrow, grieving, and joy. After all, to have such would imply complex thinking. And then, there are those who tell a different story. Living with wolves can make a difference. We continue this special edition of Your Voice of the Earth when the Wild Side News continues.
Wolves. Probably one of the most interesting and fascinating creatures throughout all time. Many cultures have been focused around wolves, certainly the Native Americans, as well as Egyptians and others have been fascinated with wolves for a lot of reasons. Obviously, the wolf has kind of morphed into what we know as our dogs, and for people who know about dogs and have had a chance to really befriend dogs, there is a bond between human and dog that is unique within the animal species. To tell us more about that, we're continuing our conversation with Jim and Jamie Dutcher, who have their new book out called Living with Wolves, which is a companion to their Discovery Channel film of the same name, Living with Wolves, and they're joining us from Ketchum, Idaho. Hey, what's it like today in Ketchum?
But just about to snow, I think. It's late autumn, yeah, so it won't be long.
Your effort was to film and photograph the social lives of wolves. That was really the focus of your work, to try to understand better the nature of the wolf and as well the nature of the pack. And so in that process, you literally became, I like to think of it as embedded in the wolf pack.
That's a very good way to put it.
as reporters. And that's kind of what you did. Your job was to witness and be part of it without taking the lead. One of the things that's fascinating about wolves is the fact that they are so different. You have an alpha male, alpha female, you have a beta male and female, and ultimately the low-ranking wolf in a pack are the omega creatures. Let's start with the alpha male, alpha female relationship. And after this much time that you've spent with the wolves, what you've come to know about the alpha male, alpha female?
Because wolves are individuals as well as part of the pack, you have to remember that from pack to pack, things will vary. What we see in our alpha, you may not see in another alpha. We found the alpha male in our pack to be an incredibly benevolent, caring leader. He was not overly aggressive. He would assert himself when he had to, especially when the wolves were feeding. He was the one who decided who was going to eat first, who was going to eat last. and everything in between, and he would pretty much oversee that. He was always the first to be alerted to any strange sounds or something, you know, going on outside the territory. And he also is the only wolf to breed. Usually in a wolf pack, only the alpha male and females will breed unless, you know, other dynamics are going on, if prey is really plentiful and the pack is small. The alpha might also breed with a beta female or allow a beta male to breed. But that's really what we saw with the alpha male. And the alpha female is a completely different story. She is a tough broad. Our alpha female started off, we thought, in puppyhood. We thought she was destined to be the Omega. She was very shy. She was always getting picked on. And, you know, you cannot predict, you know, how wolf behavior is going to turn out. And it's like a little light went off in her head one day, and she decided this was not for her. She was not going to be the Omega. And she suddenly became much more aggressive and started putting down the other female of the same age in the pack, and pretty much, you know, put herself out there to the alpha male going, hey, it's me. You're picking me.
Would some of those disputes with the other females become intense? I mean, was it really kind of a true fight of sorts?
It could be at times. The breeding rights are a pretty major deal for wolves and other animals. And basically, what the alpha female does is makes it virtually impossible for the other females to breed by attacking their genital areas. So it becomes painful. So if another female is approached by a male, she'll quickly sit herself down in the snow and like, no thanks.
Interesting.
So it's not pretty, but it works.
A lot of people wonder why it is that the wolves should be arranged in this hierarchy, but they are a hunting animal. That is what they do. They hunt, they find a prey, and I guess through time it was just determined that someone had to be a leader.
Absolutely. It's they work completely as a team.
It's this cooperation and intelligence that this animal has, and it makes it very different from cougars and bears that hunt by themselves. The bear and the cougar, they have the strength to break the back of a elk, but wolves can't do that. They don't have those kind of tools, that kind of strength, so they use the cooperation to survive.
In a hunt, is it the alpha that would then sort of determine which animal? Because if you have, let's say, a herd of elk, they may track those animals for days, watching them. They may have had fed before and didn't need to eat, but when it was time again, then they would have to literally choose an animal. Now, there's a lot of apparent intelligence going on there.
Right. The alpha male is usually a heavier animal, and the females are slighter. They're almost the size of coyotes and sometimes mistaken for coyotes. And the females would be out in front, kind of zigzagging back and forth as they're chasing caribou or elk, trying to confuse the herd, where the larger alphas or the larger males would probably bring down the animal. It's this cooperation and thinking, and they have different techniques. Like in the summertime, they may run caribou over a river bottom or riparian area where there's a lot of river rocks, and the caribou would stumble and break their legs, and that would be an opportunity. In the winter, like with caribou, caribou all in a line in the deep snow, and the last caribou would have this wolf sort of chasing and, you know, snapping at its legs, and get nervous, and everything's fine if they stay in this trail, but they would panic, and they jump into the deeper snow, and then the pack would jump on the floundering ungulate and kill it.
You know, one of the things that you had the great fortune and wisdom to do in the process of filming these, you were able to analyze some of these films by slowing down the images, and you began to discern that there was a lot of subliminal. Well, for us it would appear subliminal, for them it's direct. But anyway, communication that's happening that we may not be aware of, I think that's so fascinating. And then the sense that these animals are communicating all the time.
They really are. It's, people, when they generally think of wolves or a wolf pack, they and communication, they obviously think of howling. That's the most popular scenario. But besides the howling and the whining and the yips and all this verbal communication, there's so much physical communication going on with touching and body posture and, you know, just the tilt of the head. And it's very, very subtle. And by being able to slow down the footage, you could really see entirely new stories that were going on that you never would have caught before.
Give us an idea of some of those things. I'm naturally an ethologist. I'm fascinated with animal behavior. So tell me some of the discoveries.
Well, at the bottom of the pack, we've talked about the alphas. There's the omega, and this wolf gets to eat last. It's often picked upon, and our omega was just, actually the brother of the alpha, and surprisingly, our omega was a little bit bigger than his brother, the alpha, but it seems to be in their genes just to be followers. They're often picked upon, and sort of like a kindergarten playground. You can sort of see this kind of behavior with in children as you do with wolves. But with our omega in Lakota would always be picked on. There was one wolf in the family, in the pack, that seemed to befriend Lakota. And this was the Motsi. He was the beta wolf, the second in command. And for some reason, he always enjoyed being with Lakota, the Omega. He would befriend them. They would go off together. We would see sometimes when other wolves were picking on the Omega, Motsi, the beta wolf, would actually body check, get in between the fight and protect this friend of his. And so we could see that there were different personalities in this pack, but also different friendships.
Yeah, and this was, you know, when you were filming it, you're just seeing kind of this frenzy of wolves and you know, this mid-ranking wolf picking on the Omega wolf. But then, you know, you'd go back, or you'd be watching, and it's like, you know, there's something going on here, and you'd slow it down, and you'd realize that Motsi, you know, had actually inserted himself in between the Omega and one of the mid-ranking wolves and just broke it up, allowing Lakota to get away and sort of changing the subject. And it was, we never would have seen that otherwise if we really hadn't slowed the film down.
As a pack of animals that hunt, hunting has to be done to a large degree in stealth. Until a certain point where that's no longer an important thing. But I'm curious your observations about how much they sort of relied on body languaging versus vocalizations to communicate in the hunt and in their socialization as a pack.
It's a lot of body language. You know, a lot of tilts of the head, ears back, just the way they're moving, if it's close to the ground or more upright. They would whine quietly to each other. It's, you know, usually when you, if you're lucky enough to see wolves, for instance, in Alaska or even Yellowstone now, of course you can see them, wolves will just follow a herd. You know, they'll just be trotting along, looking at each other and looking at the herd, and they take their time. They take their time and wait. Unlike, you know, a cougar, that might be hiding in the bushes and stealthily stalking. Wolves will be very casual about it, and then when they find their opportunity, that's when they go in.
Most people are aware of this, but I think it's important to reinforce the idea that actually while they're tracking these herds, they're watching the creatures, and one of their jobs in nature is to cull out the weak or the infirm or the old.
Absolutely.
People who have dogs, one of the reasons I think that dogs and humans have bonded so closely is the fact that they read us. Our body language and their languaging through body postures, etc., are very, very similar. We have the eyes in the front of our head. We can communicate across a room all sorts of things just with our eyes or our eyebrows, the tilt of our head. As you were interacting with these wolves, what sort of communications you were able to discern that you felt were very close to our own?
During the feeding process, when they would be on a carcass, there was an awful lot of language going back and forth from pack members. And the alpha would dominate the food, and he would decide who got to eat and when. And he would just, with vocalizations and growls and snarls, pulling back the flesh on his mouth and showing these fangs and snapping. And it was, he would jump on another wolf if the wolf got too close to the carcass, but there was never really any blood involved. It was mostly just a language of going. And so he would stare at another wolf and just raise his fangs and he's, and that would be a signal for the other wolf to stay away. But there were other subtle languages that went on between the wolves, and whimpers and whines, and it was amazing. Every day we saw something different. Each wolf was so different than the other, the personalities, the characteristics, and the coloring. It's an amazing animal. When you take chimpanzees and dolphins and such, they somewhat look the same. With wolves, each one stood out from the other.
And it's interesting, you know, what you were saying, Sydney, about, you know, how dogs can read us. And it is the same way with wolves. They seem to be the only animals that know what we're thinking. We really are such similar creatures. The way they show compassion and care for each other, the way they take care of each other. Jim was talking about the wolves on the carcass. We saw something that was really quite funny. One time we had fed the wolves. They had eaten a large carcass, and somebody had brought us actually a fawn carcass, and we weren't able to freeze it. So we thought, okay, well, you know, the wolves have already left, but we'll go ahead and give it to them. And it wasn't much of a meal. It was more like just a little treat. So the alpha is on the carcass first, and he decides, you know, this is mine. Well, two of the mid-ranking wolves were watching him, and he wouldn't let them near this little carcass. And it was as if they were working out a football play. The two mid-ranking wolves were quietly whining and looking at each other and slowly moving around the alpha. And it is as if they had worked out their own plan that they were going to get this. And what one wolf did, it came in, grabbed a piece of fur, which of course made the alpha turn around and go after him. While the alpha went after the one wolf, the other mid-ranking wolf came in, grabbed a leg, ran off with that, and then the alpha had to turn around and go after him, and then the other mid-ranking wolf came in and grabbed the rest of it. So it was this great little tease they had going on, and the alpha kind of playfully chased him, and it was like, ugh.
Well, one of the things that we share, I, like you, believe that these animals have extremely complex emotions and perceptions that, yes, it is similar to our own as humans, but, you know, the truth is, and both as a scientist and as just an observer, a person, I happen to know that dogs, for example, which I've had real experience with, absolutely understand me, read me. They know my feelings, my emotions. If they feel that I'm suffering, they come over and they lick your face. If you're angry around someone, they intervene in a very aggressive ways. And I suppose maybe historically, you know, humans are not individual hunters as much as they are as well. Historically, pack animals, you know, we would hunt together, and perhaps a lot of these very similar behaviors and dynamics have kind of followed parallel paths of development.
Oh yeah, you can easily see when you watch wolves and dogs how early man and early Native Americans really learned a lot from watching wolves, from watching their cooperative hunting, watching the way they have cooperative families, and taking that on. And so you can see this bond. We need each other. Wolves need each other. And, you know, so when wolves were eventually taken in and domesticated, you know, we became the pack.
Some of the emotion that we started to notice right at the beginning of the project occurred with the very first Omega. And this Omega was very good at instigating play. You know, she was picked on, And because she was picked on, she would try to go off by herself. But as a pack member, she still would try to change the subject by getting the wolves into a game of tag. Well, because she got picked on so often, she would often go off by herself. And at one time, a mountain lion got into our territory and climbed the fence and killed this Omega wolf.
Hmm.
Now, what I want to point out here is not how this happened, but how the pack reacted to the death of this Omega. For the next 6 weeks, and they would play all the time, this pack stopped playing.
Hmm.
They would just mope around. They weren't interested in any kind of game at all. And their howling changed. Normally, wolves howl to sort of galvanize their solidarity. And the howl is full of yips and whines, and they're very excited when they howl, and they howl as a group. After the Omega died, they stopped howling, and they only would howl separately and in a very lonely way, as if they were trying to call this one wolf back.
Mm-hmm.
In the wild, we have heard reports from biologists that have found a skeleton of a wolf that had broken its jawbone. Now, the jawbone healed, and the wolf went on to live many more years, but it must have been that the pack had kept that wolf alive by bringing back food and regurgitating it. And so that we see this compassion throughout the natural world. In Yellowstone, wolves have suffered broken legs or even been trapped and continue on with the pack. Well, they would never have been able to bring down the animals by themselves. It must have been the pack that kept them alive.
Yeah, and it's, you know, it takes a lot for a pack. It would be much easier to leave the wolf. But they, you know, they are a member of the family, and they are taken care of.
You mentioned that these wolves now are a captive pack. They're enclosed because they can't be released. But when you go to visit them, they still recognize you, which to me is making the point that they do have a sense of individuality, and they have a memory and a connection with individuals, that is such that when one is lost, they feel that.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. I mean, it's no more different than, you know, you hear stories about dogs whose masters or companions have passed away, and, you know, the dog lays under the bed and, you know, won't get up, and, you know, another family member tries to take it, and it just gets depressed and doesn't eat. I mean, the wolves are very emotional, and they do recognize, you know, individuals, and each of our wolves were clearly individuals, and all taken care of by each other.
Well, we're going to take a break. We're talking with Jim and Jamie Dutcher, who have a book and movie out, Living with Wolves. So when we return, we're going to take a look at kind of another side of this, the emotional and intelligence of wolves. So we'll be right back.
Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Wolves come face to face with the humans with whom a range war has been waged for 100 years. Coming face to face with wolves is different than coming face to face with any other animal. We see into each other's worlds. The common history, which has bound us in the past, finds new expression when Living with Wolves continues on your Voice of the Earth here on the Wild Side News.
Well, I wish we had a lot more time to carry on this conversation with Jim and Jamie Dutcher, who are talking to us now from Ketchum, Idaho. They have been videographers and recordists and a team who've been creating films and documentaries about the wild creatures. And their most recent book is Living with Wolves, which is put out by the Mountaineers Books. Great folks who really bring out some of the best. And we're continuing this conversation about wolves. You know, I'm trained as a biologist and quite honest, and as a scientist, therefore, and I have a quiet war with the scientists because I feel that although they've done many, many things to document and to record, and quite honestly, the base studies in terms of populations and things of that nature have really served us well in many, many regards because we can document the populations increasing or decreasing and everything else. But there's one side to it that bothers me a little bit, and that is that sometimes when you're in a mixed crowd with the scientific and the non-scientific communities, the scientists turn their eyes up a little bit and suggest that when we start talking about these animals and their feelings or their thoughts or their intelligence, they don't really want to accept that, and I think that's doing harm to the survival of creatures. You're having lived this closely with these animals. Let's talk about what you were able to perceive in terms of their intelligence, their wisdom, and what they have to teach us.
You know, because we are not, Jim and I are not scientists, it gave us the opportunity to watch these wolves with fresh eyes and without any preconceived scientific notion. And it is a shame to not be able to, or to not allow yourself to give feelings to these animals. We observe them in a certain way, we see certain things, and we have no other way to express it or talk about it than our own emotions, and to think that, you know, we are the only creatures on this planet with the gift of emotions, I think is incredibly naive. But we were privy to a wide array of emotions and feelings, from the mourning that we saw when pack members passed away, to the camaraderie, to the friendship, to the care. It just went on and on, and you couldn't help but watch these animals every day and not see yourself, your friends, just human nature within these creatures.
What were some of the types of emotions or intelligence that really stood out?
Well, when we had to move the wolves at the end of our project, our Forest Service permits expired and we couldn't keep them on the land near Stanley. We made a deal with the Nez Perce tribes, and I formed a foundation, and we took them and sedated them and put them in carrying crates to take them up to a new enclosure, which was about 10 hours away to the north. And what really struck out, it's almost the last message these wolves gave me before I had to say goodbye, which was incredibly sad, is that how much they care about each other. When we opened the crates and let various wolves out, we started with the puppies, and then we let the alpha out, and we held the omega wolf until the very end. And we didn't think that he should get out before any mid-ranking wolves, because he might have gotten picked on. So it came time, we had all the doors of the crates open, all the pack was out except the omega. And he was holding back. He was afraid to come out of the crate. And the pack, the alpha was leading the pack, and they were about to take off to explore this new territory. And he went back, the alpha did. He went back to his brother, who was still in the crate, the omega. And they whined to each other, back and forth, back and forth. And finally, Lakota, the omega, had the nerve to come out shoulder to shoulder with his brother into this new territory.
Hmm.
And I thought that was such an amazing experience that this wolf would not, this alpha, this leader, would not lead his pack onto a new territory and explore without his full pack together, without his brother.
That's a beautiful story.
Yeah, that was a very poignant moment.
And in contrast to this, when wolves were introduced into this state, we saw photographs, and it was just tragic because there was this picture of a wolf being pulled out of the crate with a rabies collar, you know, the pole with a loop on the end, and it was probably just afraid. and the scientist or whoever was, you know, working on this with probably the best intentions to get all the wolves together, they were pulling this wolf out of the crate. It was growling with it, snarling with its teeth because it was so afraid. And this is the image that was on all the covers of the newspapers out here. And it didn't make sense to me until later on exactly what was happening then when I saw what happened with our own pack.
Mm-hmm. There are wolf packs emerging in certain states in the United States, but they are increasing in numbers, and certainly the Yellowstone pack has been successful. But let's reach out now and talk a little bit about the future of wolves and how you see, for example, the research and your opportunities to spend time with wolves, how you think that can be used to help nurture the health of the wolves into America's future.
Generally, wolf reintroduction has been very successful. And actually, we were personally not for wolf reintroduction, only because we've gotten to know these packs of animals so well and know how bonded they are to their families. The idea of breaking families up in Canada, you know, and transplanting them down here was very tragic for us. But, you know, of course, the reintroduction was going forward, and we, of course, were supporting it. And Yellowstone is a prime example of how unbelievably wonderful it is. And I think in order for the whole thing to be really successful is we need to allow these wolves to be wolves. You know, I know that there's a desire to constantly radio collar and keep track of them, and they're caught in leg hold traps to do that. We need to, if some wolves are going to get in trouble, they're going to have to get in trouble. But we need to give them the opportunity to let them be wolves. Wolves are going to leave the park. You know, they can't read the boundaries. And we're hoping that through our work and what we've learned, hoping to transmit that to other people to realize, you know, yes, these are top predators, but they're not bloodthirsty killers, the beasts of our dreams and nightmares. And in the big picture, you know, wolves, bears, and cougars take a relatively small amount of livestock compared to automobiles and domestic dogs. We're hoping we can create a better understanding where people can keep more corridors of land open for migration and just to keep our wild spaces wild so we can have these animals back and other animals like them.
Let me see if I'm understanding you correctly. You're suggesting that, well, obviously the corridors are something that my listeners are pretty much well aware of, and that is the reconstruction of contiguous areas for these animals to roam so that they can move. This is what I'm going to propose in my own analysis here, and that is that what you're saying is that to leave the animals, and they will have to, in essence, fend for themselves. Those who wander beyond the safe zones may be taken down for various reasons, but maybe this is what I'm beginning to sense that I think is reasonable. These animals are so aware, I believe they are, truly aware of the world around them. They know where the dangers are, they kind of know where the boundaries are, and that through time it may be possible for them to establish their own awareness of the right places and the wrong places to go.
Absolutely.
I know, for example, when I worked in a park in Minnesota, it was amazing that during hunting season, when deer season would emerge, the deer somehow knew, and they would go right into the park maintenance areas and just herd up there, and they would stay. Now, I don't know how in the world they knew that or how they figured that out, but somehow they knew that at hunting season you go there because they couldn't be shot there. And perhaps through time, it may be that the wolves themselves will be able to learn where those boundaries are, because I think they may be sensitive to that. Are we heading in the right direction here?
Yeah, absolutely. It's, you know, for instance, you know, with all of the best intentions, and I don't have the details right in front of me right now, but there was a female wolf that kept leaving Yellowstone, and you know, they kept going back to get her and bringing her back, and I think she ended up having her litter outside the park, and she was captured again, and so were the pups, and they were brought back into the park. And you have to think, well, how many leg hold traps and how many tranquilizer darts, you know, before you really mess this wolf up?
Mm-hmm.
And you just, at some point you have to decide that if some wolves are going to make mistakes, they'll make mistakes. You know, but we have to let them be wolves. You know, we have to let them figure out their place. And it's tough for us, especially here in Idaho, because, you know, they're talking about as soon as they can delist these animals, they want to open up a big game hunting season. And that's the worst thing you could do, because these are such family animals, as in we were discovering with elephants. You know, you kill the knowledge, you basically kill the family.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the same thing with these wolf packs.
Yes, there would be no natural selection process if they were open to hunting.
Right.
It's just whatever animal happens to cross your path is taken down, as opposed to encouraging this natural selection, which certainly exists dramatically in the species.
Right. A lot of it just is over fear of an animal that's being reintroduced. I see a lot of the controversy is the ranchers don't like the federal government probably more than they don't like wolves. And the wolves are really not killing that many sheep, say in Idaho. There was about 183 of them killed last year.
Wow.
Well, coyotes killed 5,000 sheep last year. So, and no one's calling to kill off all the coyotes, but wolves are reintroduced, as they have been in Yellowstone. It has been very successful. I mean, that park is, the biology of that park is much better off than it ever was before. The herds of elk that were in the park, they were dying off from winter kill all the time. And now with the wolf back, the elk that used to hang around the river bottoms in the riparian area are now up on the slopes of the hills looking off and making sure they don't get snuck up on by wolves. And so they're surviving up there and getting away from this delicate river bottom. And now shoots of aspens and willows are coming back. Prior to the wolf, there wasn't a cottonwood tree that was younger than 70 or 80 years in age. Now there's more trees in the river, along the rivers. There's more shade. There's more, because of that, the water is cooler. There are more trout, and they're growing bigger. There are more songbirds. Prior to the wolf coming back, there was only one beaver dam in the whole northern section of the park. Now there are 10.
Hmm.
And so it's a hugely successful program where we have a natural boundary. We have boundaries that keep them safe, but the trouble is they don't know where those boundaries are, and they do wander out and get in trouble. But I think the trouble is exaggerated.
I don't think that anyone would have been able to predict the outcome in Yellowstone, that literally the landscape is being transformed. Because of the wolf reintroductions. You know, one of the things that the wolves are always fighting against, and that is the myth that these are killer animals, that if you happen to be walking along somewhere at night, the wolves are going to attack you. Quite honestly, to this date, I still don't know that there is an authenticated attack, unprovoked authenticated attack on humans by wolves.
Yeah, there's been no attack in North America of a healthy wild wolf going after a human being.
That to me is absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, and how many people are hurt or killed by cougars or mountain lion? I mean, cougars or bears.
I think there are about 300,000 dog attacks a year.
Wow,
that's our best friend, right?
We don't have to be scientists, okay? We'll just have some fun here. I'm going to suggest that because that is, from a scientific perspective, really quite extraordinary that these animals that can take down bison and elk and all sorts of major creatures do not attack human beings. Now, I don't know that it's just because of fear, or is it perhaps, let's go ahead and have some fun, is it perhaps that they actually feel a kinship with humans? What do you think?
Oh, boy, that's scary to go there.
But you know what? I think you could be absolutely right on, because they're in the Lewis and Clark journals, there are stories about how wolves would wander into their camp in the middle of the night and not attack anyone, but steal their shoes. You know, they'd want to steal their shoes, and, you know, the guys could, like, kill them by hitting them over the head with a stick. Wolves are very, very curious, and they're very family-oriented, and, you know, we're very similar, so I definitely think there could be kind of a kinship thing happen. I mean, you know, wolves definitely should never be considered pets, but we do have a camaraderie with each other that should be respected.
Now, the wolves in the packs, I mean, you mentioned, for example, the Omega, who just seems to be the brunt of all things bad, that when they need to pick on somebody, they go after the Omega. There is this incredible dynamic that exists within the wolf pack. Now, I'm trying to imagine, because we don't have to be scientists 100% of the time in this conversation, that as wolves perceive humans, they see a very similar, almost like brother-sister species that they don't connect with any other animals.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, even within the pack, very few animals are ever killed.
Right.
You know, although they could easily, they don't tend to kill their own. I guess apparently once in a while, if there is the quote unquote lone wolf that may come into a pack, that can be a dangerous situation.
Right, and you know, and it can happen. But just having a conversation and not trying to analyze it, I think that's could be quite right on.
I truly think that our behaviors are so similar, particularly our eye glances and the connections that we make with our eyes. We all know about that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, romance begins with the eyes, and as well fear and all sorts of things. And I think these animals who are so aware of their environment, perhaps, I'm going to have fun, I'm going to say it, look to us as a special creature in their world. I otherwise, I can't explain why they haven't killed humans.
There I think you might be right.
Yeah.
Are you planning to expand on this or continue this investigation into the future here with either these wolves or others?
Well, we've always thought we'd go on from this, and now it's been 15 years of working with wolves. We dream of other projects, and we circle back to wolves. They seem to need a voice. We lived with them for those 6 years, and acquired all this footage and images, and that's why we put together this new book and this new film. They opened up their lives to us, and we were able to capture their images, so we feel that we owe it to them to continue talking about them and telling the stories they told us.
Yeah, and we've been going traveling the country and for the book tour and doing lectures, and just really trying to get the word out there that this is an animal that needs to be looked at with respect. And as Jim said, these wolves gave us so very much that it's the very least we can do for them.
On your book tours, how are people responding to your...
It's really touching. People say, thank you for doing what you're doing. There should be more people like you. That makes us feel so good. And that happens from place to place. It's wonderful.
Yeah, and we also hear from people who, you know, who were on the fence about wolves, or really rather anti-wolf, and they see the book or the film, or they come to one of our lectures out of curiosity, and at the end they say thank you. You know, I didn't realize they were such family animals. I didn't know, and it changes them. And that's what we're trying to do.
I know that my connection with wolves, it's instinctive. I bond with their myth, their reality, their world. I think they carry a message for us, and we need to wake up and listen, quite honestly. For people who want to learn more about your work and perhaps are interested in seeing your films and getting your books, give us some entree.
Well, you can find our books on Amazon.com, of course, and our films as well, and also at the Discovery Channel. And you know, our new book is through the Mountaineers, and we unfortunately don't have a website yet.
Well, we'll have to talk about that.
I know everyone does.
Help you get this out there. Too much time in a yurt, perhaps, huh?
Yeah.
On the Discovery Channel, do you expect that they will be repeating the Living with Wolves film?
I think they're planning to repeat it in December on Animal Planet, but I'm not really sure. But it is available through Discovery.com at their store as well as our previous film. Wolves at Our Door, and that's also available at Amazon and various bookstores. One thing I think is really important about these animals, that they really showed us which is something we could really take away and learn from them, is these animals really forgive each other. And it's so very hard for us to do that.
Talk about that.
Well, they'll have their squabbles, they'll have their disputes, and you can clearly see two wolves might be angry with each other. But 20 minutes, an hour later, you can see that they're friends again. They're licking each other's faces or they're lying together. And that's something, you know, it clearly showed us that, yes, they can have their little disputes, but they forgive. And how hard is it for us to do that with each other?
I'll tell you, I just got an emotional rush as I began to say, and they've been forgiving us endlessly.
Yeah. Decades.
You know, for our transgressions. They do keep forgiving us and still welcome us as almost their own.
Mm-hmm.
It's extraordinary. So now let's give us your best thoughts. Give us your sort of spiritual poetry about wolves. But sometimes, you know, when people start talking about this, there's some things we don't want to say because it may sound, we could be criticized. But we have real strong feelings. And I think it's important sometimes for us to go ahead and just speak those feelings and those perceptions or truths, because sometimes that's where the real truth lies. So I'm going to give you an opportunity to go ahead and say what you maybe don't say often, or whatever it is that you care to share.
You know, the most important thing about these animals is the amount of compassion and care they have for each other, for their family, and how they work cooperatively with one another, and how they really reflect who we are. We can watch wolves and see so much of ourselves within them. And I guess the hope that we can take that and turn it into something good and, you know, really realize that this animal belongs here. It belongs here as much as we do. And as soon as we realize that and learn to live with this animal, I think it'll be a much better place. Because as I said before, this animal will forgive. And that's something we need to learn.
You know, as you look out to the future, I think the future of many animal species, there has to be sort of a whole new way of thinking. Mm-hmm. And to some extent, the scientific world, which serves us well in so many respects, but sometimes this desire to kind of make sure that there is no crossover between the wild animals and humans could run into trouble, in the sense that perhaps the vision of the new future is that we must learn to cohabit, share the space, and maybe that's something that we have to learn to do better, because there is no future for these animals, quite honestly, if we cannot learn to live with them. They're here to share their lives, their truths, their understanding. They have much to give us, and I think we need to learn to be open to accept that and live in peace with these animals, because otherwise, as with tigers and gorillas and chimpanzees and other animals, that we keep kind of setting them off in enclosures and other places where they will not survive forever, because those enclosures have become smaller and smaller and smaller, whether it be a national park or a sanctuary. Perhaps we have to kind of, this is my own personal little mantra of today, to learn better to cohabit with these animals. We don't have to kill them all the time.
Absolutely. They need the space, and as we encroach further and further into their territory, you know, we both lose out. Absolutely.
Well, Jim and Jamie Dutcher, I want to thank you so much for adding your voice to the Wild Side News. You've done some great work. I'm anxious to keep on learning about what you folks do. In the past, we haven't even mentioned this, but you're Emmy Award-winning filmmakers and recordists. And I want to thank you so much for your work and as well your thoughts today on the Wild Side News.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Sydney.
This is our pleasure.
Mm-hmm.
With so much at stake, the future of the wonder here on Earth, this voice of the Earth seems so meek compared to what the Earth needs right now. The Earth could use a good howling, the song of the wolf heard round the world to their closest friend and most dangerous enemy, Listen to the saw-tooth wolves, who speak for all the wolves of the world. They can talk to us. They do talk to us. If only more people took the time to listen. This is Sidney Wildsmith saying adios until next Thursday, or any time on the archives, when your voice of the earth is heard round the world here on the Wild Side News.